used for a racist political agenda.
So the next date is April 13th.
April 13th will be in court, and hopefully the earliest release date is April 17th, and we hope to welcome him home on that day or in one of the succeeding days.
We want to thank you both for being with us, and we want to continue the conversation after the show with a web exclusive that we'll post online. Bob Boyle, lawyer for Herman Bell, Jose Saldana, formerly incarcerated in New York State prison, knew Herman Bell well, now an organizer with the group RAP, Release Aging People from Prison. I want to wish Matt Ely a happy birthday. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for a paid year-long social media fellowship. Deadline May 6th. Go to democracynow.org.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Positively Revolting.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Join rubab master Humayun Saki for his first performance in Oregon and sitarist Josh Feinberg for short solo sets. Then they will play a set together in the second half of the concert. Refreshments and concessions will be served. Again, that's Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Is a proud co-sponsor of Reclaim Tomorrow on Monday, April 16th at 5 p.m. at Wilson High School in Portland. Reclaim Tomorrow will show the documentary film Tomorrow, followed by breakout groups that will help participants get involved in a local level. Tomorrow presents constructive solutions that people on a local level have employed to make a difference on a global level. Tabling at 5 o'clock with food at 5:30 and the movie showing at 6. Again, that's Reclaim Tomorrow on Monday, April 16th at 5 p.m. at Wilson High School, 1151 Southwest Vermont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning, good morning. It is about 4 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock in the morning here in Portland, where you are listening to KBOO Portland. And this is your very own community radio station. I'm Ani, and this is Positively Revolting. This morning, my guest is Dan Handelman. Dan is with Portland Cop Watch and Peace and Justice Works, And we are here to review a panoply of topics this morning. You know, as I was just saying, it seems like the world has been on fire for a little while. I've been doing this show for 24 years, and Dan has been a frequent guest over the years as we look at just an array of topics that are outrageous, that are maddening, and that need organizing around. And still, I'm here this morning going, Dan, there's more to talk about than ever before. How does this happen? How do we keep in these cycles? Well, that's the discussion that we'll be in this morning. So, Dan, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So there's let's start out with just a couple of things that are coming up in the next couple of weeks that people might want to know about, to get involved with. Next week, we'll actually have a whole show dedicated to the first thing that we want to mention. And that is, you know, Portland has a history with the Terrorism Task Force. And we had gotten out of it, and we got back into it. So we need to get out of it again. And to that end, something is happening on Tuesday, April 17th. Yeah, Dan?
Yeah, right. There's a bunch of groups been working on a campaign for a little over a year now, but we kind of unveiled it in November to get the Portland Police back out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, JTTF. And, you know, as you're dedicating a whole show to it next week, I won't go into too much detail, but basically in the year 2000, before 9/11 ever happened, there was a city council agenda item that we, Copwatch, noticed where they were re-upping a contract between the city and the FBI to have two officers dedicated to this task force, which is supposed to be rooting out alleged terrorism, but it was pretty clear that they're also focused on activists, which is kind of the history of the FBI. And we organized a lot around it. We pushed and pushed to try to get people out. And then 9/11 happened, and we filled City Hall, even though 9/11 had just happened. And of all things, Charlie Hales, who was on a commissioner back then, was the sole vote against re-upping with the task force in 2001. So they stayed in. Mayor Tom Potter, who was a former police chief, came in and said, I cannot oversee the officers in this task force because I don't have a security clearance. He pulled us out. Then Mohammed was set up by the FBI. We had this fake, this is fake news. I mean, the FBI created a fake bomb. I hate saying that word on the air, but that's what it was. And they told him that he was going to be hurting people, and basically they entrapped him, and that now he's serving 20-something years in jail, in prison. And unsurprisingly, Portland decided to join the task force again, despite public outcry. So we're campaigning to get out, and there's a guy named Michael German, who's a former FBI agent. He came out to testify in 2011, right after the Mohammed thing, to try to explain why it's a bad idea. He's going to be coming back again to be this the keynote speaker at this forum. And then we're also going to have a local panel of people from different groups involved in the campaign, including the ACLU of Oregon and the Council on American Islamic Relations, Japanese American Citizens League. And then we're also going to have Brandon Mayfield, who was wrongly targeted by the FBI for the Spanish train bombing in 2004.
Right.
So, and then we'll take questions from the audience. So that's going to be 7 o'clock on Tuesday, April 17th at the Maranatha Church, which is at 4222 Northeast 12th at Skidmore.
And again, we'll be talking about that next week for the entire show. So just to put that up on your calendars, it's a sort of save the date moment for more information. If people want to study up before this event, before Michael German comes to town on the 17th, where can they get more information?
It's funny you should ask that, because you can go to the Portland Cop Watch website, and on the front page is a link to it, but you can also go directly to portlandcopwatch.org/pjttf.html, and that's where we have information about the forum and the campaign, and you can link to a easy to use ACLU page to contact city council, tell them to get out of the task force. And our letter that we sent to the council has 24 signatures to it, and it's a wealth of information.
All right, thanks very much for that. And then just a couple days later, the Department of Justice is going to be holding a hearing.
Well, sort of.
Sort of hearing?
It's the DOJ themselves aren't holding it. It's Judge Michael Simon, overseeing. Okay, so in 2012, the U.S. Department of Justice brought a lawsuit against the city of Portland for unconstitutional excessive use of force. I'm going to just say that's what it was about, because people often misrepresent what it was about. It says unconstitutional use of force, particularly against people in mental health crisis. So that doesn't mean everybody that was subjected to unconstitutional use of force was in a mental health crisis. It means that that's just the people they noticed having it happen most often. Now, you and I know that most of the people who are subjected to use of force are African American. Well, not most, but a disproportionate number.
Yeah, right.
And it's something that the DOJ should have included in their investigation and their findings. They mentioned that there were problems in the community, but they couldn't prove, they said, that the disproportionate targeting of African Americans was deliberate. So they didn't use that as part of the lawsuit. In any case, once the lawsuit was filed, the city came to a settlement agreement with the DOJ saying, we're going to make these 100 and some odd changes to our policies and training and all these things to so you can go away. And here we are 6 years later. those changes aren't done. The city has filed two separate appeals to drag the process out. A year ago in January, the Community Oversight Advisory Board that was set up to help the community relay information to the DOJ about whether or not the changes were working was dismantled by the city. And Judge Simon was supposed to hold what's called a status conference. Annually since it finally got entered, which wasn't until 2014. So there was one in 2015, an annual status conference, and one in 2016. It was supposed to hold one in 2017 because of the city's appeal, which I don't want to get into the huge details of, but because of the city's appeal, it was delayed, and now it's being held Thursday, April 19. And we want to make sure that people turn out for this, so I'm going to be really careful to say when and where it is. It's Thursday, April 19 at 9 o'clock a.m., at the federal courthouse downtown, which is on Southwest Salmon and 3rd. And it's got airport-like security, so if you're going to go, you remember, don't bring anything that they're going to think is a weapon. Bring a ID. Make sure you're going to be able to make it through their metal detectors and so forth. And then you go to Judge Simon's courtroom, and my understanding is the first hour is going to be the judge, and then there are four parties at the lawsuit, which again, I can go into the details if anybody cares, but there are four parties at the lawsuit. Each one is going to give a little 10-minute spiel about whether they think changes that city council passed last year are fair, adequate, and reasonable to fix the problems with the original settlement agreement. And then we, the community, will have 3 hours collectively to say whether we think it's fair, adequate, and reasonable. And we can also talk about whether the original one was fair, adequate, and reasonable. We had a day and a half long fairness hearing when this was first put in place in 2014. So I think it would be great to have a lot of community members coming out and talking about whether or not these changes to the police bureau are making them less apt to use force. And I think a lot of people who've been to protests probably can tell the judge that the police bureau is not less apt to use force than they used to be.
It certainly seems that way. Mm-hmm. As a, say, casual observer and occasional participant, it definitely seems to me that the police in Portland have not de-escalated their violent response to dissent, or really to the daily work that they have to face them, which brings me to this year, let's look at what the police have done in Portland. Dan, as you were noting, the first woman in 15 years was shot. I saw some stats that nationally were already breaking records this year in 3 months into the year for police killings. It's just like 2018. We're number one. It's like an epidemic, a nightmare that we can't wake up from. Locally, what's been happening?
Before I get to answering that question, I just realized I want to just finish up with that DOJ, the fairness hearing, because in the afternoon of that day, Thursday, April 19, that everybody has on their calendars now, that's when the status conference happens, where the DOJ and the city are going to explain to the judge what's been going on, whether or not the reforms have been going on. So there are two separate questions. One is changing the settlement agreement, and the other is has the police been making the reforms that they're supposed to be doing? So that's the entire afternoon of that day is going to be the parties arguing to the judge whether or not the city's in compliance with the agreement. So what's been happening locally? Well, you mentioned the first shooting of a female in 15 years. The last woman who was shot at by the Portland police was Kendra James in the year 2003, and it was May 2003, so it was almost exactly 15 years apart. And the woman who was shot, so Kendra James was an African-American woman who was in a car with three other people, and the police knew her, and they pulled everybody else out of the car, and at that point she was kind of freaking out, so she jumped in the front seat, started driving away. The officer, quote unquote, feared for his life and shot her in the front seat of the car. And then they didn't get medical help right away because they thought she was faking, and it was just a horrible...
It was just incident. I mean, again, it was mind-boggling. And immediately, not to interrupt your narrative, but to interrupt your narrative, immediately to me, it brings to mind, like, as a pedestrian, oftentimes I feel like, you know, there's cars that are perhaps coming at me, even if I have the right of way, even if I'm crossing at a light. It doesn't occur to me to shoot the driver. It occurs to me to get the heck out of the way.
Yeah. Well.
So, but I hear this excuse from police officers across the country when we see them shooting people in cars, often unarmed African-American people in cars, that they had no choice but to shoot the driver because they thought they might be hit.
You know, in this case, he thought he was going to be dragged because he was actually in the V of the door, trying to pull her out by her hair, which was a wig, and so it fell off. But technically, all he had to do was step back, and the car would have driven away and not hit him at all because he was in the V of the door and not in front of it. And right, there's no piece of the car that was going to hit him. So yes, but yes, your general observation is correct. So the woman who was shot was not African American, much to our surprise, I guess. She was a white woman who gave the name to the police of Sarah Michelle Brown, but the media is reporting that her real name is Alexis Elizabeth Wilder, so we're not really sure what her name is. They've actually given two different ages for her as well, but she's in her 20s. Apparently she was in the process of committing some kind of robbery. This is what this police story is. I'm not saying it's necessarily true. And then they chased her, and she took shelter under a porch. They shot at her and wounded her with two bullets. She shot back at them. You can make your own decisions about what it's like when somebody shoots first when the other person hasn't actually shot at them. And she was wounded and lived, which is, you know, also kind of rare and not necessarily a bad thing. That they didn't, you know, so she can actually live to tell her story. One of the two officers that shot her is a guy named Daryl Shaw, who is one of the worst of the worst. Now, you know, people always talk about rotten apples. Now, our view at Portland Cop Watch is that, you know, it's not just rotten apples. We have an institutional problem.
It's a systemic issue.
Right. But we do have individual officers that we have seen over the years do things over and over again. So I have a short list of things that Daryl Shaw did if you want to listen
Please.
To some of it. In 2004, he pulled over an African-American driver to search him without probable cause, and that man's case was dismissed. I think the previous year, in 2003, he drove up to a nightclub that was mostly attended by African-American patrons, and he strapped a gorilla doll to the front bumper of his car and didn't realize why that would be offensive. Allegedly didn't realize.
Right.
In 2011, a female recruit said he was involved in the bloody beating of a teen shoplifting suspect. In 2006, a woman said he slammed her into a wall and used other force when she was trying to have him let go of the wrong person he was detaining. And she sued, and in 2011, unfortunately, the jury sided with the officer, Officer Daryl Shaw. And in 2010, a person was tasered and ended up getting a $110,000 settlement for that. He was also apparently involved in a shooting in 2000 where he shot at a van and missed, and We do not have that in our records. I don't know how the Oregonian dug that up, but I'm going to try to find out more about that. So that's quite a lot of violence and racism from one individual officer. And that's just what we know about.
Right. And really, when it comes to racism, the Portland police have demonstrated a long history. I was only born in the mid-60s, so I only know of the racist history of the Portland police in a firsthand way since, say, the late 70s when I first kind of became aware. And but certainly when you're talking about the horrendous act of strapping a gorilla doll to the front of a police cruiser and showing up in an African-American patronized nightclub, just kind of throws me straight back to the possum incident at the Burger Barn on MLK. And that, again, what is going on? What is going on when these officers do these things? They're still on the force. There's not really a huge public outcry, certainly nothing from the oversight of police from the city level. There's an outcry from the community, but what is going on that there's really no address for the systemic racism that is prevalent not only in the Portland police, but across the country? That's sort of the question of the day.
Oh, sure. And, sort of a rhetorical question, because we have systemic racism and they're protected by that same system that perpetuates the racism. But on that note, the city auditor just came out, and we have our differences with the city auditor, but she came out with a report about the gang enforcement team, which released statistics that aren't a surprise, since Portland Cop Watch published similar statistics in 2016 based on a city publication, but that they overstop African Americans, the gang enforcement team, not a big surprise. Around 60% of their traffic stops were of black people. But that's 60% of the ones they recorded. They made 1,300 stops and they only recorded 800 of them, because the other 500 they said were just mere conversations.
Just a little conversation. I just casually wanted to talk to somebody. I was feeling a little lonely after lunch, so I wanted to pull the car over.
Right. That's what I do all the time.
I see that. I want to invite our listeners to call in and join the conversation this morning. I'm just sort of running on pure outrage this morning. I'm saying it. I'm a little sputtery because really, as I've been reading, just over the last couple of weeks, there's been three cases that have hit national headlines. Goodness knows how many more folks have been murdered by the police across this nation that haven't made national headlines. But I want to go ahead and invite people to join our conversation. And that number to call is 503-231-8187. Give us a call here at Positively Revolting. I'm Ani. I'm talking with Dan Handelman. This is KBOO. We're your community radio station. We're talking about police violence. We're going to be talking about war and seemingly never-ending war and the absence of an anti-war movement here as well. There's connections, and we'll be talking about those in a moment. But we want you to join in the conversation, so please do give us that call, 503-231-8187. I was sort of getting ahead of myself there. Over the last couple of weeks, we have seen the outrageous murders of Stephen Clark in Sacramento, who was shot 7 times in the back as the police officer feared for his life because there is a man standing with his back to him, holding a cell phone. I see how that could, definitely cause somebody to fear for their lives. I see men standing with their back to me holding cell phones, and I think all the time, what am I going to do? Danny Ray Thomas was a man who was experiencing a mental health crisis in Houston. He had walked into an intersection, had his pants around his ankles, clearly unarmed. The police officer who responded yelled, "Get on the ground, get on the ground, or I will shoot your..." I don't think I can say that word on the radio. The fellow didn't respond. And in fact, he was killed with one bullet to the chest. Then Saheed Vassil, just 2 days ago, in New York City was a man who apparently was also experiencing a mental health crisis, who was holding a metal pipe with a knob on it. It's been alternately described as a shower nozzle, who was, again, killed by Brooklyn cops. So in that case, the local beat cops actually had said to the media that they knew Saheed, that they knew him to be a kind man who had bipolar disorder and who was, you know, generally you could talk to him. Unfortunately, the officers that responded to the 911 call were not those beat cops. They did not know Saheed, and they murdered him. I know murder is a legal term, and I'm pretty sure that if passed as precedent, we will not see indictments and we will not see charges brought against these cops, just like the cop that murdered Alton Sterling got off without those charges. And that was also news in the last couple of weeks. But I think I side with Helen Caldicott. And I think that the world would change if we quit using euphemisms. Hmm. And I want to call it plainly like I see it. When you are shooting an unarmed person who is actually not presenting a threat to your life, if you weren't wearing a police badge, we'd call that murder.
Well, and regardless, it's called a homicide, right? The one of the worst things that I hear about, none of these cases that we're talking about are alleged in this, is when they the authorities and the media use the term suicide by cop, because there's no such thing, right? That is, it's always a homicide. And I think, you know, if you want to not irritate people who get mad when we say murder, say it was a homicide. That's true. One person killed another person. It wasn't an act of God. On the note of racism and police shootings, here in Portland last October, there was a young man who allegedly robbed a bank, and the police here saw him pull out what turned out to be his wallet, and they shot him and wounded him. His name is Chase Peoples. And that was the first shooting under our new chief, Chief Danielle Outlaw, who came up here from Oakland. And she didn't really speak to the injury to Mr. Peoples after that incident. She was, you know, we kind of got a cut and paste. We're going to investigate this fully kind of news release. And when Ms. Brown, if that's her real name, was shot a couple of weeks ago, it was kind of the same thing. We're glad no officers were hurt. And while I have a lot of hope for some of the things that Chief Outlaw has been saying, and we at Portland Cop Watch actually had a meeting with her, it was very, you know, encouraging. But still, you know, if you're going to show yourself to be in alignment with both your officers and the community, I think it's fair to say, well, it's a good thing none of the officers were harmed. We're sorry that a member of the community was injured, but we're not hearing that still.
Yeah. Yeah, and that disparity in treatment is troubling at mm-hmm. best. I want to welcome Deanna into the conversation. Good morning, Deanna.
Good morning, Ani, and good morning, Dan. Thank you so much. We can't have this conversation enough.
Yeah.
I'm wondering or thinking about a couple of things. One is that this law about when a policeman feels threatened is easily a huge problem that I think we have to overcome, because that means go ahead and murder anybody anytime I felt afraid for my life. And as someone with more knowledge and experience than I has pointed out, all people in this country who've grown up with racism have learned through the propaganda and all the stuff that we've been taught to believe that black people are to be feared.
Yeah.
And black people are terrified of police for a very good reason, and of white people for a very good reason. So now we have everybody terrified for their lives, but one side has the authority to kill. So I know that we have to struggle and fight with all this DOJ, and I'll be there, but I'm wondering if we can't change this law. Police should not be able to say that I am afraid for my life and that's why I shot this person. That has to go. It has to be something different, like, I don't know, deadly force was coming at them or something like that. I don't know what the law should be, but it sure can't be that, because they'll always, always get away with that. That's one of the things, that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deanna.
Well, I think that's worth exploring. Certainly, I'm a member of the steering committee, the Albino Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, which is one of the four parties to that DOJ suit. And they have been trying on and off over the years to get a statute in Oregon modified. In fact, that's one of their stated goals of that coalition, is to change that statute so that it's not so easy. From my experience and what I've heard and seen over the years, we have a higher issue because the Supreme Court ruling about when officers can use deadly force essentially says that if they fear for their lives or another member of the public's lives, that is, it's okay under the law for them to violate that person's Fourth Amendment rights by seizing their life. That's what, it's a Fourth Amendment issue, basically. So even if we change the Oregon statute, the officers might get off through an appeal through federal courts, just so you know. So we have, that's a much larger thing. We have to work with our allies around the nation if we're going to change all that. But that being said, I think one of the things that we've learned at Portland Cop Watch too over the years is that we see all of these officers shoot people who are unarmed or not posing any kind of real threat and never getting prosecuted. And maybe if it's worth narrowing the criteria that the Portland police use to say whether it's justified to shoot somebody, so that at very least they will be fired for shooting somebody. And even if we don't get the officers prosecuted, because that is a very rare occurrence around the country, much less in Oregon. So if you think about that, that is actually where we're headed with the DOJ agreement, that the police are supposed to be using less force than is constitutionally allowable. But so far that hasn't translated into any punishment for officers who use deadly force.
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and talk to Edith. Good morning, Edith.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Annie. I have a question, more so than a comment, and wanted to know if you have any statistics on police shooting of Hispanics or Mexicans, if anybody is keeping a tally on that.
Yes.
And I know there, you know, this might be another topic for another day, but if you know of any organizations that are keeping tabs also of those Hispanics that are stopped and then referred to ICE. Thank you. I'll just take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, Portland Cop Watch, every year now, is putting out a letter to the Attorney General of Oregon, because there was a law that was passed in 2007 that requires the state to publish the names of all the people who were killed in the state of Oregon. They have never done that. It's been 10 years, and they've never done it. So we've been doing it as a kind gesture for the last several years. And we don't always get the ethnicity. And I don't want to make assumptions based on people's names, because I think that, you know, can get us tripped up in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. But there are actually certainly several people in 2017 who were shot here in Oregon who have Latino surnames. If anybody wants to do research on those cases and find out whether that was their heritage.
Yeah, I also just want to throw in, this is something I've seen, I could have sworn I saved the page, but I do know that disproportionately killed by the police nationwide, actually Native Americans are the ethnic group of people who are killed the most, with African American people being killed the second, and Latinos being killed the third. Whites, you know, interestingly enough, seem to be killed less per capita than any other race. So that is what I remember. I'm sorry, I can't pull the statistics directly out right now, but we will continue to talk about this category, to talk about this issue of disproportionate police killing, because it is indeed a part of systemic racism and it must be addressed. Also, your second question, Edith, about the incidents of Latinos being stopped by police and then referred to ICE, I don't have any information or statistics about that. And that is something I will continue to look into.
Right. Yeah, we don't have statistics. I mean, we certainly are getting a lot of anecdotal yes. stories here in Oregon about people who are being either pulled over or, you know, the ICE goes to people's houses. Like, they went to a house where somebody's home was being renovated and tried to take people in. And a Latina who's on a, I think the school board, the David Douglas school board, was racially profiled on public transit a little while ago. I mean, it's just all sorts of stepping up of that kind of racism and targeting of the Latino community, certainly.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk to Nina. Good morning, Nina. Nina or Nina? Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yeah, Nina, that's right.
Nina, okay.
Good morning, guys. First of all, I wanted to say two thank yous. Thank you for being as exasperated as the rest of us and airing it publicly so that we can all join in on the public exasperation.
Right.
And also, thank you very much for mentioning the fact that Native Americans are killed more often than African Americans by police in this country. I think that's an appalling statistic, and the fact that it's rarely ever mentioned is just completely dehumanizing in so many ways. So thank you for mentioning that. That's something that needs to be explored and talked about just as much as the African-American, people getting shot by the police. So thanks for that. I wanted to say two things. First of all, I have a friend who is a person of color in Portland, and he is harassed almost on a daily basis by police officers for seemingly no reason at all, to a point where it's getting a little scary. And I believe that one day I am just going to get a call saying that something's happened to him. I believe it's just a matter of time. And I've been thinking recently, I know it's a bit of a silly idea, but I want to strap a body camera onto him because I want him to record everything that happens to him. In the event that something does happen, it can be fully recorded. And I know that's a ridiculous idea to go around strapping body cameras onto every person of color in this country, but that's kind of...
I don't think that's such a ridiculous idea, actually.
I mean, I just feel like the police have the body cameras. The people that are being victimized don't, and... You know, maybe that's something that would tell another side of the story.
Well, and the police have the body cameras that seem to be conveniently turned off at crucial moments. Or, gosh, they had a battery failure.
Exactly.
Or, you know, in the case of the cop that killed the man in Houston, he was issued a body camera that morning, but it was in his car charging at the time that he had to get out and shoot the unarmed black man walking across the street with his pants down.
Exactly. No, right. It's a very convenient problem that they have with the body cameras, but I think obviously requiring every person of color in the country to wear a body camera is a ridiculous idea.
But I don't. I mean, you didn't start with the premise of requiring everybody.
No,
you
obviously.
Wanted to give your friend one, which is not a bad idea. I mean, you remember the name of our group is Cop Watch because we watch the cops, and that's we don't need the cameras on the officer because it's not going to show what they're doing. It's going to show what they see, or not even what they see, but what the camera's pointing at, which is sometimes not what they see.
Right.
So what we need is people pointing cameras at the police, and that's your idea fits right into that.
I think that's a brilliant idea, and I think if there was any way to implement it, even just on a grassroots scale, where people just start walking around with them, I think that could be a very interesting start. And I also just did have one more suggestion, and I don't know if it's something that's already happening in the country, but I was wondering if there's some sort of application or some sort of even shared database where people like my friend who are harassed on a daily basis can take the badge number and the name number of the cop who harassed them and just go in and record the incident and to start to see if there's some sort of pattern with certain police officers who have a history of constantly harassing people. And maybe if we start compiling information that every time somebody feels like they were unjustly stopped or harassed or targeted by the police, they could just write it down and we can kind of have a general collection and start collecting the data to see if there's any sort of patterns that are happening here. I just think that may be something that might help in the future.
Nina, thank you very much for your call. This was probably a good time for you to talk about the work of Cop Watch, Dan.
Well, actually, I was going to talk about the work of another group, which is the Unite Oregon, which helped push through a racial profiling bill in the state legislature a few years ago. And as a result of that, there is a centralized place that everybody in the state of Oregon can file complaints about racial profiling. Now, the caveat is that, unlike the caller's suggestion, they're not going to release publicly the names or badge numbers of those officers. And we don't actually have badge numbers in Portland. We have Department of Public Safety standards and training numbers, just so you know. But that's okay. It's close enough. But somebody could create such a database. We've not really done that specific thing. We do take calls on our incident report line, which is 503-321-5120, and we try to keep it confidential. So it's kind of like a trade-off between gathering information that people tell us and posting it publicly, because if we do that, well, for one thing, we don't have the resources to investigate and see whether or not the complaint, whether there's any evidence of the complaint. So that creates all sorts of legal questions. Mm-hmm. But second of all, if we tell people it's confidential, then we want to make sure it's confidential. But that said, somebody could create an online thing like that, but I would suggest consulting with an attorney ahead of time, because it may be that the police officers who are being accused of this will not like their names being published in that way.
Strange. Who could imagine? Dan, what's the number for the police reporting line again for Cop Watch?
503-321-5120.
All right. Just for the heck of it, I will go ahead and post that number so that people can have it handy. I will post it to Positively Revolting's Facebook page. Yes, it's true. You can still find us on Facebook. You can like the page. You can follow along. You can also find us in the Twitterverse, where we are at Positive Revolt. You are listening to Positively Revolting on KABU, your community radio station. And we have about 18 minutes left, and the bases are loaded. Mm. Let's go ahead and talk to David. Good morning, David.
Hey, morning. A couple of different things. I'm calling you from San Francisco, and I'm trying to get a local cop watcher to call in. And the earlier caller was asking about a database, like a national one. I'm pretty sure there is, and I've forgotten which one it is. So maybe I can get a second caller to call in and give you that. I work at activism from an economic angle of it, and looking at police training. If these police are so cowardly that they've got to shoot a guy with his pants down, or, there's so many of these shootings that are, erratic and stupid, and, the 11-year-old boy with a toy gun and whatnot. Yeah. If the police are so badly trained that they have desire to shoot because they fear, then they're not a good quality for the police forces. The taxpayers are badly served by them. And so, I think going after the training methods is obviously a direction to go. And for the police administrations and the police boards to be hiring companies that are, urging shooting for body mass as opposed to shooting to wound, or using discussion techniques to calm someone down. Well, I was just looking at the video from I think it was from New Houston, where they're shoving a guy's face right into the concrete. Apparently he was he had epileptic seizures, and that's why they were going after him. And they basically fought him for, and punched him any number of times. But looking at this body camera, they're shoving his face into the concrete, and it's no wonder the guy is struggling.
Mm. Well, yeah.
And so I'm just an interesting phrase that I like to use is a paranoid with a blank check. That basically the police boards are paranoids, whether it's the military-industrial complex and Dick Cheney, or whether it's the local police boards. They cry, and, it's like Dick Cheney, "I'm scared! I'm scared! Give me a new arms system! Give me a new missile system! More tanks!" And it's like they have these loud, booming voices, but all they're talking about is how scared they are. So it's an interesting propaganda technique for the military-industrial complex or the police-industrial complex to get richer.
And there's actually, thank you for making a great segue here, David. Actually, there is a strong connection in training tactics that have come into prevalence over the last 30 years, Dan, that basically militarized the police force. Mm-hmm. And the direct comparisons can be made. I really thank you for that observation.
Well, and moreover, that is, that was why Portland Cop Watch is a project of Peace and Justice Works, which is our parent group. And I think Ani's trying to lead me into discussing. So what we did at Peace and Justice Works a few weeks ago, we went down to City Council on March 14th because the mayor was asked to proclaim April 21st, coming up just in a few weeks, will be USS Portland Day. And I don't know how many people out there know this, but there's a giant warship that's coming to visit Portland. It's actually going to be sailing up the Willamette River on the 14th, so a week from tomorrow, Saturday the 14th. And it's going to be docked at Terminal 2 at the Port of Portland for an entire week. And there's going to be a private commissioning ceremony that has 6,000 seats that were already given out to mostly military veterans and people, whatever. That's fine if they enjoy paying tribute to the conflicts that they were part of at one point and they want to purge their inner demons. But I think that when it comes to spending money on war machines, we shouldn't have a hundreds of feet long giant warship that's equipped with 9.50 caliber anti-surface machine guns, 2 30-millimeter anti-surface guns, and anti-air missile systems, and I read a laser cannon of some kind, named after our city and proclaiming a day in its honor. So we're going to be doing something to protest that. If people are interested, they can call Peace and Justice Works at 503-236-3065. We're particularly thinking that in order to be seen, we're probably going to have to hoist some large signs up in the air for a lengthy period of time. So if there's people who feel like they can stand up for 15, 20 minutes at a time and maybe take turns holding stuff up, let us know. We're actually having a Iraq Affinity Group meeting. That's the group that works on our peace issues on Monday at 7 o'clock at our office. So if you want to call 503-236-3065, you can get more information there about that.
Good point. We down here in San Francisco, we had the Peace Navy, and maybe you can find your local chapter of the Peace Navy to do some opposition. Hey, one last thing before I go. I noticed one of the companies that does training that's very militarized is called Asymmetric Solutions, and I think it's Asymmetric Solutions USA, and the city of St. Louis just cut their contract because of a lot of abuse, and so they... what's interesting is they have chapters in Mogadishu and Somalia. So they're very clearly something tied with like Blackwater and mercenary development. If you go to their website, they are not a police training operation. They're very clearly more a mercenary operation. They have, they sport all of this high-tech, high weaponry. And, the basic idea in American Constitution is that the posse comitatus, that the police are supposed to handle civil problems and they're not supposed to be militarized. And this whole idea of paranoia justifying more and more militarization of the police not only gets into the training, but into the just, I mean, can you imagine somebody running with their pants down get shot to death? That's something that would have been laughable back in the cowboy days. They would have shot the sheriff for doing that. So it gets into the paranoia becoming normal.
Yeah. So before you go, I just want to congratulate San Francisco because your police pulled out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force down there last February, and that didn't really make a blip on the national radar, but that's one of the things that inspired us to start pushing Portland to get back out up here. So,
sure. United you stand, divided you fall.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, David, thanks so much for listening and calling in this morning.
And so before we get to the next caller, he was talking about training. Just so people know, I talked about Daryl Shaw earlier, who was involved in the shooting. One of the officers who's now the lieutenant at the training division here, and we do, Portland police do their own trainings. I don't know who's hiring outside consulting firms to do their trainings, but that's very interesting. His name Leo Besner, and in 2005, Leo Besner shot a guy named Raymond Guerter in the back with a sniper rifle. Raymond Guerter was talking on the phone with a hostage negotiator at the time about his dog, and you hear the recording, and you hear, oh, my dog's really playful, and the was because Leo Besner shot him in the back. That cost the city $500,000. He roughed up a teenager in 2003, costing $177,000. He punched a protester in 2003, costing overall with other protesters $300,000. And then in 2007, three officers, including Besner, roughed up African-American men, pulling them forcibly from a car, costing the city $175,000. So we call Besner the million-dollar man for all the lawsuits that he's... And now he's training other officers. He's the lieutenant in the training division.
Oh, really? That's so fabulous. I would think that I've reached some sort of limit that I could be shocked or outraged by any of the information you give, Dan. And yet, I have no limit, apparently. Because, man, that is that's kind of devastating information. Mm-hmm. Just to say. Let's go ahead. And we have, 9 minutes left. Let's talk to Ted. Good morning, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
I was wondering if you'd say something about the police union. I don't really know what it is. Is it a nationwide union? Why is it so powerful, and why is it respected when other unions are under assault?
That's really such a good question.
That is a very good question. And so we use the word union in quotes when we talk about the Portland Police Association, because it is not a union in solidarity with other trade unions. It is an association. It's not part of the AFL-CIO, even though the AFL-CIO helped them get their union when they first started. Obviously, when there's a picket line, and the management calls in somebody to break it up, that's going to be the police. So they, we know whose side they're ultimately going to be on, is the state side, and that's who they're hired by. So the Portland Police Association and other unions like it, which they're all individual. There are some affiliations of fraternal organizations of police, and our Portland Police Association started one here in Oregon for the Oregon officers' unions called ORCOPS. I can't remember what it stands for. So they bond together, and they lobby in Salem, and they have money. And one of the reasons that local politicians are afraid to go up against them is that as part of their deal, they can't go on strike because they have to be out on the street every day. So they pretty much then have a lot of power to say, well, if we can't go on strike, we want this and this and this. And a lot of times they get what they want. I don't know if you remember in 2016, we had a huge fight about the police contract. The city was removing what was called the 48-hour rule from the contract, which is something we've been pushing for years, but they refused to put anything else on the table that the community's been demanding for years. And as we tried to get into City Hall and demand that they make more changes, they locked the doors at City Hall. And then they, after the union contract was passed, the police did a little victory lap by brutalizing the protesters outside City Hall that day. And actually, they pushed them down the stairs to get them out, down concrete stairs. And it was a very horrible incident.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your call. Also, I'm just going to say this was published just this morning. It is from, what is it, the Sacramento Bee. And that is, Sacramento County's top prosecutor received $13,000 in campaign donations from two local law enforcement unions just days after the Stephen Clark incident. Just days after Stephen Clark was killed by Sacramento police, who shot the unarmed African-American man, and the campaign finance records show that. So, I don't, is there a problem there? Yes, there is a flippin' problem there, right? I want to remind people that you are listening to KABU. It's your community radio station. And coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, Pacific Underground hosts Luann Algoso and Don Jones Redstone of the websites Gabby Smashes the Imperialist, White Supremacist, Capitalist Patriarchy. Web series, sorry, not websites. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views visits to the Corvallis Library. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, the Radio Geekly tries to unpack the good versus evil dichotomy within the realm of geekdom. And we, of course, want to thank KABU members for your support. You keep us on the air. You keep us independent and strong. Please participate in People's Media by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button to become a member of KABU today. And we thank you again for doing that, because we are stronger together. We need each other. Let's go ahead and let's see. I think we're up to Dave. Good morning, Dave. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
First thing we've got to do is route the Klan back into the basement where they belong. Second, Dylann Roof, the cheeseburger eating killer, should have been a cop. And I read in Omni magazine, I know you remember Omni.
Oh yeah.
I read in Omni back in 78 that they were going to develop gun cameras.
Huh.
What happened to that? Thank you very much.
What's interesting, Dave. You know, Taser International, which is the number one manufacturer of electronic control weapons, or actually, I can't even believe it, I call that conducted energy weapons. Shouldn't be called a control weapon. We actually pushed the bureau, and they finally are calling it electronic control. Conducted energy weapons now. It's too early in the morning. Anyway, so they do have tasers that have video cameras on them.
Hmm.
But they just don't have guns with those yet. I don't know why. Maybe it's too cumbersome. I don't know that much about weapons. I don't want to. But there was something I thought about mentioning about when you were talking about the corruption, or somebody was just talking about the corruption of the DA. The district attorney here, you can read the transcripts of most of the officer-involved shootings here, because when the person dies, they release the transcript. They actually just released the first transcript of one person who didn't die, Chase Peoples, the person I was talking about earlier. But there's a group that comes in supposedly every year to look at officer-involved shootings. It's called the OIR group out of California, and they published parts of the transcript for a guy named Kelly Svoboda. He's not a very savory character, but the DA went out of his way to paint this guy as the most horrible, you know, child kidnapping human being in the world, even though the officers at the time would not have had that information, in order to sway the grand jury. And the OIR group called them out for that. Thank goodness somebody's in the official position is finally looking at how the DA tries to sway grand juries not to indict officers. And just as a side note, Mayor Wheeler would not allow public oral testimony in the city council the day that report was presented, because he says, when there's a report, I'm not going to take testimony. Doesn't matter what the topic is. It's just my policy, which is a very poor policy.
Yeah, one could say that's a policy that discourages public discourse.
Mm-hmm.
Shame on you, Mayor Ted Wheeler. Okay, let's go ahead and take the last call, because we've only got 1 minute left, and I'm being very literal. Good morning, Edie. You've got 1 minute.
So I'm thinking we'll get more people, if possible, to protest the warship, et cetera, if they know they can hold up big signs that this will make a difference. The way you do that is you use the plastic deer fence, like the orange construction fencing that you can get at Home Depot and Tyvek, cut out the letters, punch holes in them, tie them on with a twist ties, and the wind goes through it. It doesn't cost a lot. You can have long poles on your bike trailer or your car, or you can have small poles, a PVC pipe that you fit together in your backpack or under your coat. You can show up, arrive on bus or whatever else, put up your big signs, be visible, not hurt your arms and legs, not be blown away, make it a big statement, and then go away.
Thank you so much for your wonderfully succinct motivational call at the end of the show. Thank you, Edie, very much. Some great logistical information. And with that, we are flat out of time. Dan, thank you so much for joining us again on Positively Revolting. And again, how can people get a hold of Cop Watch and Peace and Justice Works?
Our office phone is 503-236-3065. And you can go to pjw.info for information about Peace and Justice Works, and portlandcopwatch.org, which is linked there, but that's the Cop Watch website.
And next week, please remember to tune back in, as we will be talking about why Portland should get out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force in advance of Michael German's presentation, which will be on Tuesday the 17th. So please do stay tuned to KABU all day long for your information and your musical needs. And next week, we'll talk again. Thanks very much.
There comes a time when every second, every day.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next is Pacific Underground.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting this great station, and you can apply today to join our board of directors to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to great use. The role played by our KBOO board of directors is essential. It's a great way to become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is April 16, 2018. We need folks who love KBOO and are committed to our community values. KBOO needs you. Apply today.